I'm Amy Hall. I'm here with Greg Kokel, and you're listening to the hashtag STRask podcast. This is the podcast where you send in your questions on Twitter with the hashtag STRask, and then we answer them. Mostly Greg answers them. And then I throw in my two cents.
More than that.
Okay, Greg, let's start with a question from Golden Amber.
Why don't you start, and I'll throw in my two cents.
I'll let you answer this one.
All right. Just checking.
Okay. How do you respond to people who say Adam was not a singular person, but rather a word that referred to man in general? And how do we respond to the assertion that others had to exist other than Adam and Eve in order for their children to marry and propagate, etc.?
Well, the second is easy to answer in a sense that, others don't have to exist for them to propagate because they have children, which then can have children together and have other children. I know that sounds like, oh, it's so gross. Yeah, but that was the only choice at that point. And that was the beginning of things. It didn't seem to be as big of a problem as maybe it seems now. In any event, so I think that second point can be dispatched in that way. Now, it may raise other questions, but that's okay. That taking the text at face value, it seems like that can happen. It does seem also that human beings lived longer during that time, so the multiplication could happen faster, and consequently, you can have an increase in population like that. And by the way, the habit of marrying close kin continued on until just a couple hundred years ago. Maybe even less than that. So this is not, I know it's to modern ears, it seems weird, but the idea of marrying cousins even goes back just even 100 years, even in this country, and it was not a big deal. Now, there became genetic concerns, and this is why laws were raised, whatever, but there weren't concerns in many cases that otherwise, people still could feel romantic towards close kin. So I don't think that's the bigger concern. I do want to deal with the first one, though, and let's just say, Jesus' name is Yeshua, which is kind of a version of Joshua, and it means the Lord saves. Well, the Lord saves through lots of people. We've seen all kinds of examples of God saving through different people in the Old Testament. Why should we consider Jesus as an individual person when his name means something general that can be a lot of people? Maybe there wasn't a Jesus, and there was just a reference to God saving. Why don't we do that? Well, the answer is pretty obvious, because when you read the account, the account sounds like you're talking about an historical person. Now, clearly, we have more detail about the life of Jesus than the life of Adam, but we still have the same kinds of things going on. We have particularities that are offered that are significant to the unfolding of the drama and the narrative. Francis Schaeffer pointed out that the book of Genesis is the book of beginnings. And so it doesn't tell us everything that happened in the beginning. It tells us the things that are important for the rest of the story, just like any beginning of any story. And since the story is about, broadly, the problem of evil and how it gets solved, one of the things that people, with regards to human beings, one question, just like in any good story, is how did this problem begin that now allows us an opportunity to think about the solution. And so you have the beginnings of the universe, you have the beginning, in brief, in Genesis, you have the beginnings of humankind, in brief, and you have the beginnings of the problem. So if this is not an historical account, at least at this point, and Adam is not an individual who fell from grace, so to speak, in a way that influenced all of his progeny, then how do we make sense of the rest of the story? That's Schaeffer's point, and I think it's an important one. If there is no historical fall, then it's hard to it's hard to sustain the biblical theology or doctrine of the fallenness of man. Innate fallenness. I mean, human beings are born fallen. You know, in iniquity, my mother conceived me, Psalm 51, David. And so these things are all tied together. And if you clip one part, the rest of it begins to unravel. And this is one of those parts that is really critical. The historicity of Adam as an individual and as a father of the human race, along with Eve, an original pair. Okay. Now, there's a lot of debate right now about whether or not that was the case, given the evolutionary paradigm. But there are lots of problems with that paradigm in general, and there's lots of evidence in favor of an individual pair. So let's just say the science at the moment is still out on that, but I don't think the theology is still out. This is quite clear. And if anybody wants a thorough defense of this notion, spend $50 and buy the book Theistic Evolution, because this is a critique of theistic evolution, and there's a whole section, one-third of it or so, is dedicated to the theological questions about an historical Adam. Bill Craig is already in the process of doing a lot of work on that right now, and if you want more thinking on that, you can listen to his podcast or go to his website. But the book Theistic Evolution, I think, is a really good does a good job theologically of covering the theological necessity for an historical Adam, and not just kind of a genus of humans of sort, men that are bad.
Mm-hmm. A couple of episodes ago, we talked about Romans 5, which talks about Adam and Adam being the head of humanity versus Jesus being the head of humanity. And that doesn't work if he's not a real person. Mm-hmm. I just want to...
It would also mean that Paul was wrong, because right. Paul is treating him as a real person. And so did Jesus, by the way. Jesus also referred, it's interesting, Jesus refers to the most controversial parts of the Old Testament, to Adam and Eve, to the great flood, to Jonah, etc., you know, and he seems to refer to them as realities and not mythic things.
One thing, if people are interested in looking into the science, Ann Gauger, and her last name is spelled G-A-U-G-E-R, just wrote a paper, and I can't remember offhand what the name of it was, but she's been doing a lot of work into the science of whether or not there could be a first human pair. So that just came out a few months ago. So if anyone wants to look up her name, you'll probably be able to find what's going on out there with that right now.
She's also one of the contributors to Theistic Evolution.
Oh, okay.
And,
yeah,
and
that's right.
On the
right,
science
yeah.
side, Stephen Meyer kind of piloted that effort, and Ann Gauger is a contributor mm-hmm. there on the science side. There's three sections of that book, one science, one philosophical. J.P. Moreland was in charge of that as editor, and then the theological stuff that... What's his name? I can never think of it.
Grudem?
Yeah, Wayne yeah. Grudem.
Yeah, I'm working my way through that book right now, so it's going to take me a while.
Amy knows that what's his name is Grudem whenever I say it regarding that kind of stuff.
I could read your mind, Greg. Okay, here's a question from Jared Bolus. In Dennis Prager's Torah commentary, he makes the argument that God's just nature, coupled with the fact that people frequently get away with injustices, necessitates the existence of an afterlife for eventual justice. Is this a good way to argue for the existence of hell?
I didn't know that he argued. I think he has. I have heard him on the air. I haven't read the book, but I heard him in the air talking about this. This is C.S. Lewis's argument. I'm not saying he stole it from Lewis or whatever, but it's a variation of the argument from desire. And what Lewis argues is that desires have fulfillments, in principle at least. So if you have a desire for food, there's food to satisfy it, et cetera, et cetera. You think of all your desires. Desire for love, well, love is available. So we have a desire for justice, okay? That means that justice is available. It doesn't happen on this earth, though, as Prager points out. So that means there must be a place when we must be made for another world, is the way that Lewis puts it. But I think there's complete legitimacy to that. In fact, it's so legitimate that this was one of the principal reasons that that C.S. Lewis became a believer. It's this argument from desire, and this unsatisfied yearning. He describes it, and what he calls joy, this unsatisfies, what Lewis calls joy, unsatisfies yearning. And that's one of the things that convinced him there must be another world in which this yearning can be satisfied. So this, I do think it's a legitimate way to argue, and evidence of that is an argument like this is what was principal in changing C.S. Lewis's mind about Christianity.
It's interesting because people can go either way with this. They can look around and see the injustices and say, God must not exist. Or they could say, God is good. Therefore, if there are injustices, an afterlife must exist.
Well, that can go both directions. The problem with the first one is if God doesn't exist, then there are no injustices.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? Because there's no way to ground or make sense of our sense of what is right and wrong. That makes sense of our notion of injustice, because justice is the kind of thing. Justice entails a notion of retribution. The bad get punished. Well, who's doing the punishing then? If there's no one to do the punishing, if there is no afterlife, how do you make sense of the notion of injustice itself? So injustice to me, that there is such a thing, is an evidence there must be some larger standard.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I do know people argue that way, but this is what I think is the liability.
Right.
They're as Frank Turek would put it, they're stealing from God
mm-hmm.
to object to God.
All right. Here's a question from Timothy Bayer. I was discussing the definition of biblical faith with an atheist, and he stated that the description, quote, faith is putting your trust in what you have reason to believe, is guilty of the fallacy of ambiguity. What are your thoughts?
Well, my question would be, in what sense is that ambiguous? What's ambiguous about that? I can give all kinds of illustrations, okay? Climbing an airplane. Oh, taking a trip. You have reason to believe the airplane is adequate to the task, but you don't exercise, and the pilot, but you don't exercise faith, that is trust, until you get on the airplane, and then you are all in, so to speak, all right? You are entrusting yourself to the plane and everyone behind the operation of the plane, the mechanics, the pilot, the crew, the air controllers, air traffic controllers, etc., in order to take you where you want to go, to do something for you. But you're in their hands now. So the question here is, for the atheist, what do you mean by that? You claim it's ambiguous. What is ambiguous about it? I actually don't know what is ambiguous about it. And if he thinks it's ambiguous, it's very easy to give a gazillion illustrations of what we mean. Why is he balking here? And the reason that the atheist is balking is because they want, I mean, I'm presuming here, I've just seen it so often, is they're trying to twist. I'm thinking of the word trust. They're trying to twist the definition of faith into being something where you have no evidence for it. What if the Christian said to the atheist, oh, I think that's guilty of the fallacy of ambiguity? The atheist could justifiably say, what's ambiguous about that? There isn't any. And there isn't any with regards to the Christian. Unless the atheist is just trying, you know, hate to ascribe ill motives to somebody, but unless the atheist is just simply trying to be difficult. Trust in something you have good reason to believe is so. Why is that? What is ambiguous about that?
Yeah, I'm with you. I don't know what he's saying is ambiguous. I don't know if he's referring to the word faith as being ambiguous, but that's what he's defining.
Of course.
I think
that's what the definition is meant to take the ambiguity out of.
Right. So I wonder if whenever this kind of question comes up, you have to do exactly what you said. You need to ask him what he means by that.
Right.
What is ambiguous? And where's the ambiguity? And then you just can explain to him where he's missing the boat. But I wonder if what he's doing, the atheist is doing here, is saying, you can't use the word faith that way because I think faith is something different, which is not the fallacy of ambiguity at all.
No, it isn't. It's maybe there's an equivocation going on here because the atheist wants to define faith his way. And my response, and I was very clear of this in The Story of Reality, that atheists are free to define faith for themselves any way they want. But they are not free to redefine it for someone else. So if they're going to critique the Christian's view of faith, they have to deal with the biblical notion. They cannot twist it and distort it and then knock it down. That is a fallacy, and it's called a straw man fallacy, okay? So that's what's going on in that circumstance, I think. They don't like the word faith, and they want – this is very consistent across the board with at least the public atheists. They want to redefine your terms in order to make your view look foolish. And this is what we are not going to allow. We have to insist that if they're going to critique our view, they have to critique our view, not a distortion that they've made up.
Okay, let's do one more here. This one comes from Kelly Y. What is idolatry? Does it include watching TV, reading novels, following sports? I have a hard time understanding this fully.
The simple answer is probably not. It probably does not involve doing sports, watching TV, or whatever. This question seems to be coming from somebody who's coming out of a very fundamentalist atmosphere where they're identifying kind of details of modern culture, like TV or sports or something, as immoral in themselves. Now, if you've ever seen the movie Chariots of Fire, there you have Eric Liddell, who is doing, you know, famous missionary who died in China and also a gold medal winner in the Olympics at one point. But he refused to run on Sunday because he thought it was against his religion to do sports on Sunday. Now, I remember when I visited the Soviet Union in 1976, when the wall was still up and it was in communist control, that we were told, be careful about talking about playing sports, like just shooting hoops. Because they thought sports was worldly and unchristian. So you have slices of culture who have very strong feelings about some of these things, like watching TV, playing sports. I don't know what the other one was mentioned.
Reading novels.
Yeah, I've not heard that as a problem. And so why would anyone think that this is an example of something sinful in general, especially the sin of idolatry? You know, I think the first novel that was ever written was, or very close to it, was the one written by the Puritan. Well, there's two of them that come to mind right now. One of them is
Pilgrim's Progress.
Pilgrim's Progress, but that's all an allegorical story. But the other one is the guy on the island. What's that?
Robinson Crusoe.
Yeah, Robinson Crusoe, which is not a you know, Swiss Family Robinson story. It's a Christian tract when you read the original that's unexpurgated. It's great. So these were ways of people communicating spiritual truth. I don't know why somebody would think that reading a novel is immoral. Now, I think it can be said in a general sense that you can make a god, a substitute god, out of anything. And I think that does happen in people's lives. And so people who are pursuing their career above all else and everything is sacrificed to the career are treating their career like a god in their life. And I mean, everything morally required of their life, like their family, their marriage, other things, responsibility, these are all sacrificed for this golden calf, so to speak. And I think it's appropriate, fair, accurate to refer to that as an idol. I personally think that that way of referring to things is way overused because, you know, I hear all kinds of people talk about, oh, that's idolatry, blah, 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 blah. That, you know, when I don't think it's really an example of it, certainly none of the things in themselves that were described there in the question are examples of not only not examples of idolatry, I don't even think they're examples of sin. Sports, reading novels, you know, watching TV.
So how would you define idolatry?
Well, I would say making this thing the central feature, focus of your life, rather than making God the focus of your life. What are you following? If you're following your career, that's it. That's an idol. That's not, if you're not following God, but you're following something else, and God is the one who deserves your following, then you've made an idol out of that thing. That is the thing you're seeking to manipulate and to appease and to appeal to make your life work and to make it better, et cetera, mm-hmm. et cetera.
Well, thank you, Greg. That's it. We're done. We're
Alrighty.
Out of time. Thank you, everyone, for your questions. We really appreciate it. And thanks for listening. This is Amy Hall and Greg Kokel for Stand to Reason.